So good evening. So tonight we'll continue the exploration of renunciation that we started at the beginning of the month. The last talk we looked at renunciation as being informed and directed by compassion. I'd like to keep that in mind as we explore tonight, which is looking at how renunciation can be informed by wisdom. So it's very important to keep this kindness of heart, this sense of orienting our investigation, our practice toward compassion, toward the areas of difficulty with a softness, with a kindness. So if we don't put that overlay in, then we tend to go with our normal habitual judgment. It slips in very quickly, very subtly. And it can cause a lot of mischief. So looking at how renunciation can be informed through wisdom and actually it can direct renunciation. So first off, what do we mean by wisdom? I think it's important to step back a second and look at that. So wisdom or wise shows up in many places in the Buddhist teachings. Certainly the Eightfold Path, we talk about wise view, wise intention, wise action, etc. So there's that wise aspect prefacing all of those path factors. Also, ignorance and wisdom are kind of the counterbalances of each other. We can almost frame the whole practice as a movement from ignorance, from not knowing, to wisdom, to a clear sense of understanding how things are. It's such a critical aspect because everything boils down to our ignorance really is what everything springs out of. You know, in terms of our difficulty, our suffering, our neuroses all come from that deep sense of not knowing how things are. Now, a simple way to define wisdom is what leads to freedom. You know, wisdom is what leads to our heart's release, to our liberation. While what's not wise leads more and more toward our suffering. So these kind of juxtapositions of which direction, any moment, how we're relating to it through our sense of ignorance, of clinging, of resistance, of contraction, or a sense of openness, a sense of wisdom that informs the moment. We can also look at wisdom around these three characteristics. And this is kind of the kind of bottom line understanding of what is wisdom in this tradition of dukkha, of anicca, and anatta. So dukkha, often translated as suffering or as this unsatisfactory nature of life, of much of existence has this unsatisfactory quality to it. Another characteristic is that of anicca, of impermanence, that things are always in flux and always in change. And finally, anatta, or non-self, that as we look in this assumption of who we are, this perspective of me, we see that it's just another illusion, another thing that arises and passes away. So clearly, seeing and understanding these three grounds us in wisdom. So there is a point when it becomes unshakable, that this becomes the bedrock from which we live, that we go through life with these three characteristics as a clear understanding. So it permeates our being, and then from our being permeates our actions. So wisdom isn't about book knowledge or a sense of academic study. This is really a direct seeing, a direct knowing. And this is what the practice offers us, is this possibility to see for ourselves, to see all of these in a very clear, direct way. The practice is not the only way. There's, as many of us go through life, you know, there's many examples of people who grow wise in this way. I remember my grandfather, when he was the last month or two of his life, we were having a chat one afternoon, and he said he was a Christian person, and he was saying that this too shall pass is often considered one of the most profound phrases in the Bible. So this too shall pass, can hear that sense of impermanence that's inherent in that phrase. Now, it's nice to say that, you know, this too will pass, you know, if it's something difficult, but also to hold that with things which are pleasant and enjoyable. And it's a completely different thing to say when you're on hospice, when your life is, you can see the end of your life approaching, that this too shall pass includes the sense of who he was. And so, you know, I can just feel the weight of that, but also the wisdom in that, that this is just a natural part of his life, of living as well as dying. So then how does wisdom start to inform renunciation? How does this come back together? I think it can be very helpful to frame it. I always like to make things as simple as possible. You know, seeing whatever doesn't lead to freedom, whatever leads away from freedom, then that's something that we work to renounce. We work with our renunciation around that, releasing that. Something that's not informed by wisdom, that's really driven and imbued with wisdom, that's something that's worth considering renouncing. Now, this is an important point that will all come back in different ways tonight, and it also comes through with the practice and reflection. It's not about what arises in your experience, right? Because you can be sitting, meditating, going through life, and a sense of longing comes up, wanting something particular. Right? The fact that it arises, there's a conditions that allow that to happen up, that allow that to show up in that particular moment. It's how do we relate to it that matters. How we relate to that which arises, not what arises in itself. That's a key thing, because otherwise we tend to go back to trying to make ourselves be a certain way, okay? Judging this particular emotion that arises, this particular mind state that arises. Externally, you know, we paint that outward also, that sense of this has to be a certain way. So when it arises, whatever it is, it's how we relate to it. That's where the renunciation may lie. Or if the relationship is that of wisdom and compassion, then there's a just abiding with it, a sense of deepening into it. Often when something arises that we have resistance toward, there is that very much sense of wanting to push it away. Gathering it toward us, too, is a very similar quality to that. It's almost like we want to invest in that system, in that organization that arises around that sense of friction. And so renunciation is this willingness to, okay, this sense of longing comes up, that sense of wanting, instead of going into the fantasy around it, into the thinking about it, into how do I act from it. There's a sense of just noticing that impulse and coming back into the body. Renunciation. Now the Buddha, in one of his suttas, talked about two kinds of thought. And this sutta, there's a few suttas out there. They're interesting because the Buddha's talking about before he became awakened. He's kind of saying, this is what worked for me. This is what my practice was before I had my big shift, when I really became enlightened, became awake. So the two kinds of thought. This is from the Middle Length Discourses, number 19. So he's saying, monks and nuns, before my self-awakening, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisattva, the thought occurred to me, why don't I keep dividing my thoughts, thinking into two sorts? So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, and thinking imbued with harmfulness on one sort, and thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness, another sort. So you get a sense, he just had this insight that as thoughts arise, there's thoughts that lead to more contraction and ones that lead to more freedom, right? The ones of ill will, of contraction, of grabbing, of pushing away. There was one particular kind of thought. This other kind of thought is one of release, of openness, of interconnection. So the sutta, you get a sense of how the Buddha practiced. He often would have, look at some struggle in his life. And as he would say, okay, let's look at this clearly. Let's clearly see what's here and separate out these two thoughts. And as each one arises, to really pay attention to that thought, to really attend to that thought. So as the sutta goes on, as I remain thus heedful, ardent, resolute, thinking imbued with sensuality arose in me. I discern that thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me. So there's that sense of knowing what's present. But going further, he saw that that leads to his own affliction, or the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes fixation, and does not lead to unbinding. So this is he's pointing to a very direct way of practicing. If something arises that has a quality of, let's say, craving to it, a sense of contraction, maybe contraction is a better word. As that arises, to first really notice that it's arising. And I would say not only notice it intellectually, but much more importantly, feel it in the body. Feel that sense of contraction in the cells of your being. What does it really feel like to have that contraction? Right? To notice that. And then notice where that thought leads. What's the natural outcome of that thought? And when you start to see, you know, through repetition and through clear seeing, how those thoughts lead to more suffering, then there's a natural releasing of those. There's a natural falling away. So he goes on and talks about ill will in that same way. And then he goes on to say, As I noticed it, that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. As I noticed that it leads to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both. As I noticed that it obstructed discernment, promotes fixation. It subsided. So whenever thinking imbued with sensuality had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. So you have to be careful of that language, because it's not about suppressing it or pushing it away. It's about so seeing it so clearly that you naturally release it. Like picking up a hot stone and feeling it burn, you don't have to be told to keep picking it up. And as he goes into this whole layer of thought, which is unskillful or you know, leads to more and more suffering, and also this less level of thought that leads to liberation. As I remain thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with renunciation arose in me. I discern that thinking imbued with renunciation has arisen in me, that it leads neither to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It fosters discernment, promotes lack of vexation, and leads to unbinding. So he clearly saw that this way of relating to my moment's experience, his moment's experience, leads to this unbinding, to this release. So this is a nice model as we start to work with renunciation and really imbued with wisdom, is that sense of discernment. As something arises in our experience, how do we meet that? Are we meeting it with a quality of kindness, a sense of openness, or a sense of judgment, of constriction? So it doesn't matter what arises, it's how do we relate to it. Doesn't matter what arises, it's how we relate to it, including our judgment of what's arising, or our judgment of our judgment. So wherever you catch it, that's a saving grace. Wherever you catch it, you can just, okay, let me just meet this, right? And meet it in the whole body. Feel the body experience of it, and can there be a sense of the body relaxing with it? And when there's a reason we give the instructions the way we do, right? You know, being still, being relaxed and alert, that's cultivating the same quality of mind to meet all aspects of experience. So realizing it or not, you're practicing it from day one, how to relate to experience. You just sometimes I think we get caught in just the breath or just the body sensations. But it's important to realize as these patterns of contraction get triggered in our lives, though they too can become an object of practice, an object of meditation. It's like you're going into it with the whole body, or inviting the whole experience into the sense of knowing. So back to this wisdom and renunciation. So knowing these three characteristics is a very important way for us to use wisdom as a guide for renunciation. So let's start with the first one, with the dukkha. So how does dukkha relate to renunciation? So last week's talk, I focused on how we can actually be sensitive to the pain that life brings to us, and how that pain actually is an invitation for renouncing. You know, it's not done because we're trying to force ourselves or judge ourselves to be a certain way. It's actually a sense of compassion, caring about the pain that's present in our minds, our hearts. So when suffering, in terms of wisdom, when suffering is present, wisdom starts to look to see where the bind is, where the stuck spot is, where is the contraction. And this is an interesting process, because when we really have something that's very gripping, whether it's usually interpersonal or just our sense of who we are, our deep judgment about who we are, it has this whole kind of rich, painful story around it that we've often rehearsed for many, many years. You know, we've acted it out, we've had people reinforce it, people who have denied it, we kind of blow those off. Back in my youth, I worked on the trail crew for a summer or two. And so one time we had this job of putting this bridge in. So we had these cross beams. We had this beam and another beam on top of it, right? So you get a sense of that. And we're kind of cutting them out like a log cabin or a dovetail joint. So we're, this is a Forest Service wilderness area, so we were always using just hand tools. Very primitive hand tools, axes, and maybe a little carving knife. And so as we're working on that, we got it mostly shaped, but it wasn't quite fitting right. You can tell it just wasn't quite right. That sense of not quite rightness is that rub. There was a little piece, maybe an inch square, that was stuck, that wasn't quite fitting right. So then we'll take some dirt and kind of mark it so we can see where to carve it out, and it was a process of back and forth. If we looked at those logs and got distracted by the length of the logs and trying to maneuver from far away, we would not ever get to that bind. We had to really go in a sensitive way to see where is that bind actually showing up. Okay, same too with dukkha when dukkha arises. Like just as I was preparing this talk, something came to mind that was been a difficult experience, kind of a triggering experience. I could just feel myself going into the whole story of it and all of the meaning around it. And then I said, okay, where is really the rub here? Where is the heart of what's stuck? What's the deep belief behind that? As that belief started to emerge, that sense of not belonging or not being important, as that was able to connect with that, then the story became much softer. And then there was this point of that rub, that sense, that belief that was very much held, that's the point of renunciation. Not renouncing the fact that this whole story arose, but there's the deep belief underneath it that's maintaining it. So connecting with that deep belief. So when I say connect with it, it's really a somatic lived meditation with it. Really feeling the echoes, allowing yourself to feel the echoes through the whole body as you're connecting with that belief, the whole logic around it. Even the sense of, at one point I became embarrassed about it, because I went to renounce, to have this practice of renouncing it. I could see there's a little bit of like, well, I kind of like it. I kind of like being in that role. It kind of, there's a power in being a victim or being pitiful. it's funny. It was embarrassing to see it, but also it was really eye-opening to see that too. There's often a deep investment in our pain. And so that's where that sincerity of heart comes in. You know, are we really wanting deep freedom, a sense of complete liberation of our heart, or do we want to have, you know, this sense of our contraction, our identity, and that freedom? You know, they can't be compatible. The sutta I was reading, the Buddha talks about being heedful, ardent, resolute. Heedful, ardent, and resolute. So that's, those words are repeated many times. It's like we really have to bring a lot of attention to this. It can't be kind of this kind of foggy, I'm going to look at it a little bit. It has to be the most important thing in that moment. So your whole attention, all your faculties focus in on this one thing. The reason for that is there's such a momentum of ignorance around it. There's such a momentum of not seeing, of being unclear. And so there's that ardency, that sense of heat, being very heedful, very focused, allows you to start to penetrate through that fog, to actually see those deeper binds. And so dukkha, as dukkha arises, instead of trying to change the circumstances, see, okay, this is an opportunity to really connect with, you know, what's arising, what's present. Yeah, so it's not about disregarding our pain or repressing it. It's welcoming it in, you know, so it's fully embraced, fully seen. We see where that bind is, what needs to be released. So this is this quality of using kind of our personal dukkha, our interpersonal psychic dukkha that gets triggered to motivate renunciation, to inform renunciation. Renunciation, though, also can be triggered by the dukkha we create in others. I remember, it's been a few years, I've kind of worked on this habit a lot, but when my wife and my daughter, we would be going on a vacation, and I would become very tight around time. Like, we have to get going, you know. And of course, there's always, you know, different things to do, and, you know, corralling cats kind of a thing. But the harshness that would come out of me, you know, the words and the actions, and at one point I just saw how much suffering that was causing my wife and my daughter. And in that seeing of really letting that dukkha be felt, to really let that into my system, there became, without any effort, the urge to renounce that, to understand it deeply, to understand the underpinnings, the deep beliefs behind that, and to see if there's a way to release that, to not cause harm, to continue to cause harm. Because I also knew just trying to say, okay, I'm going to try not to do that pattern superficially, or just trying to will myself through it, it would just come up again. I knew I had to go deep to its deepest roots to understand that pattern. You know, the need to have control, the need to have some sense of certainty. And by doing that, I was faced with, okay, what if I do let go of control? What if I do let go of a sense of how things should be, my own limited understanding of how this situation should be? You know, there's the fear of that, the release of that, you know, the sense of being undefined, out of the driver's seat. So that's really, the renunciation often has that edge to it, because you're really letting go of some of the deepest, most cherished things in you, some of the most painful things, but they also have a very cherished quality. So this is this quality of dukkha informing renunciation. Now dukkha, one of the reasons that dukkha is so prevalent is because of the next characteristic, and that is of anicca, of impermanence. You know, if we could just kind of set things just right, we could get the bathwater just perfect, and it would never change. We would never get pruny or bored or have to go to the bathroom. You know, that would be really nice. It's like, you know, in space, I guess, if you threw a ball, because there's no friction, it would just keep going forever, right? But we have, you know, things, you know, decays and it grows. And so life is always in this process of things arising and passing away. And so this characteristic of anicca, of impermanence, wisdom really sees this as a direct understanding, a direct knowing, not an intellectual thing, something that really goes into our bones, into our cells. And wisdom sees the inherent suffering that's caused. We want that fact to be different. And back to my grandfather, so he hadn't shaved for a few weeks, and at some point he wanted to go shave. And so we kind of cleared some space and took him in his wheelchair to his bathroom. And I will never forget the moment when he saw his face. This is the first time he's seen his reflection in maybe a month or so. And as he saw that, his response was like, "Is that me? Is that me?" Because he was dying. His face had changed so much he could barely recognize himself. The reality of anicca. Anicca, that things change. Things arise and they pass away. Things are birthed and they die. So renunciation is really this sense of releasing our resistance to this fact. So as he saw that, I often reflect on how being privileged to be able to be around him in the last month or so of his life, just seeing how there's a kindness to the dying process. There's this gentle reminders that, this life is winding down, that you can't, your bodily functions start to go, your body wastes away. And that allows the mind to start to accommodate to this fact of anicca. And so too with our own practice, we start to have a mind that's more soft around the fact of change. Now, we may feel that tightening, that wanting things to continue. Okay, can I soften around that tightening? Can I allow myself to start to relax around it? So renunciation often takes this form of softening the resistance. Feeling the loss, the grief, but knowing that this is a natural law of life, this is a natural fact of life. This is what it means to be alive. In Nietzsche, we can often look at it from the worldly winds, which is this, it's a really a nice list of these qualities of life that we often hold ourselves in one side of it. And when we hold ourselves in one side of it, we experience suffering when that side falls away and the next one comes. So the worldly winds of pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute. So I often, when I feel myself having fame or praise, I also hold, okay, there's also gonna be blame. when there's a sense of disrepute, when there's a gain, and I gain something, there's also be loss. This is two sides. It's this world that we live in. And so much of our suffering is from that place of wanting it to be one way versus the other. That sense of wanting it to be a certain way. And renunciation, the wisdom component sees that wanting and says, okay, that's something I can start to renounce. Can I start to allow myself to participate in this flow of life, this fluxing of life, instead of trying to be outside and holding it back? It's like I've told the story a number of times, but my daughter, when she was young in preschool, they went to the beach and made these sandcastles, and the waves started to come in, and there's all this activity to try to stop the waves, right? But the waves kept coming in, and so, it's natural, but there's this sense of, can we build a castle and then realize that at the same time that castle will fall apart, will be washed away, swept away. So you start to get a sense of this balance of mind, this capacity of mind to hold whatever arises. And as something arises that we contract around, that's an opportunity for renouncing, for releasing. As a meditator, as I teach beginning classes, I really urge people to practice every day. Because if we just practice when we're feeling good and everything is quiet, that's the kind of mind we cultivate. When we practice in every kind of weather, every kind of experience, then we develop this capacity to hold, this confidence to hold the whole array of being human. Right? Rumi's The Guest House, just to pull out a couple of phrases from that. You know, every morning is a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. And some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Welcome and entertain them all. This is this quality of the heart, fully meeting whatever is arising. Even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. I used to think that was a really beautiful line until I started to really notice that sense of having my furniture swept out. It's like, hey, this is intense, this is painful. But at the same time, I could see as it's sweeping out those possessions, you know, that sense of belief, that sense of identity, I did see, as the poem goes on, that he may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And in this way, our very contraction becomes our spiritual practice. You know, the very loss, the very sorrows that arise. As our practice matures, we take it off the cushion into the fabric of our lives. We see that as something catches us, contracts us, that's an opportunity for going into it, to open to it. And renunciation, I think, is a beautiful quality. And it's often when the wisdom is really there and the compassion is there, renunciation becomes effortless. It's like, this is the only thing that makes sense. So dukkha, the characteristic of anicca, of impermanence. And the final characteristic is that of anatta, of non-self, or anatta. Now, non-self, this is really underpinning these first two, really the fundamental aspect. Because everything that we struggle with, everything that we want more of, want less of, there's inherent in that experience the you that's wanting or not wanting. Do you see that? It's like it's inherent in it. We so much focus on out there. You know, before we practice, we're usually focusing on trying to get rid of it or trying to get more of it. As meditators, we start to say, okay, I'm going to really notice the experience of wanting and not wanting, and I've been told I'm not supposed to keep doing that, so I'm going to kind of practice being still. But eventually our curiosity turns toward who is really wanting. What's this perspective? What's this place of location that we want from or don't want from, that we suffer from? And who is the person experiencing this? Who is this happening to? And when change happens, you know, who is the person that wants things to be a certain way, to not change, or to change quicker than the natural rate? That's the same thing. It's like we want something to grow quicker. There's also that quality of not being in tune. Yeah, I hope you get a sense that this practice leads to being more and more in tune with life, more and more harmonious with life. If you read some of the Japanese, you know, Zen stories, there's often this compliment of someone who's very deeply practiced that they're very natural. They're very much in sync with a peace in their environment. So this sense of self is really embedded in both anicca and also dukkha. It's actually the fundamental premise that allows these to arise. The fundamental premise of self allows dukkha and the struggle with anicca to be present, to arise. Because if there wasn't someone there, there wasn't a sense of me to lose something, to grieve something, that grief would just flow through very smoothly, very easily. So renunciation ultimately turns toward this quality of self, this quality of who we take ourselves to be, this sense of me. So first two, as we work with those, start to quiet down the array of things, kind of the frenetic energy. And it starts to clarify more and more clearly where the deep bind is. And that's how my practice unfolded, is learning to connecting with the breath, connecting with the body, and then starting to be more and more quiet and noticing what's the perspective that's seeing. And then saying, okay, what's the perspective behind that and behind that? And becoming quieter and quieter, more and more sensitive, to feel that quiet little bind, that quiet little friction that need to orchestrate. Last time we talked about the forms of practice, the sense of external form and the inner form, kind of the secret teaching. And so the outer form of a practice, sitting still, noble silence, a retreat, the precepts, these all create a chance for us to start to quiet things down, a quieting of the reactivity. My limited understanding of a nuclear reactor kind of comes to mind, that you have these nuclear small molecules that are bouncing off each other. And the more that bounce, the more and more of a reaction that arises. And so too with our reactions, when we get reactive, we spend our lives in reaction, that cultivates more reaction. It gives the seeds for more reactions. It actually becomes the fuel for more and more. So the forms of renunciation start to allow that reaction to quiet down. So it actually goes the other way. It starts to go to more and more peace and stillness, open-heartedness, and biting of the heart. See the two thoughts, the thoughts that lead to contraction versus opening. And as we quiet, become more and more quiet, there's a clearer seeing that's available, a clearer wisdom that starts to arise. And that wisdom in itself starts to inform our discernment, starts to lead to clearer and deeper renunciation. So it's this beautiful positive feedback loop that as our wisdom grows, our compassion grows, allows us to have more wisdom, more discernment, and deeper renunciation, which then allows even deeper wisdom to arise. And so the practice starts to feed itself. So the sense of anatta, the non-self, just to talk about it in a very simple way, in a very hopefully accessible way, and to point that we're softening that tendency, we're working that process of softening the reactivity, renouncing that sense of self in small ways that build up over time. Every time we sit, when we sit and fully experience the breath without a need to make it be a certain way or just shape it, but just to really notice that breath, just to notice that sensation. In doing so, we become much softer. The sense of who we are has become softer in that moment. With a bare attention, without a need to label it or identify it, there becomes less and less distance between what is observing and what is observed. The sense of self becomes very quiet and may even completely fade. Renouncing shows up in our lives in terms of this third characteristic. And whenever you're in a sense of listening to somebody, when you fully listen to them, when you stop planning what you're going to say or kind of doing the inner debate, when you completely let them in, not only their words, but their emotions, their whole being in, you've set aside some of your sense of self. You've softened that. And that's often, it's really beautiful to watch that as someone begins to practice, their people around them start to reinforce that this is really a helpful thing. In this last beginning class, someone was reporting that the people she supervised had really noticed that she was different with them. This is quality listening to yourself, allowing yourself to to just have that breath, that sensation. It teaches, it naturally expresses outward. And these outward expressions are so important to start to reaffirm what we're learning on the cushion, what we're learning in our practice. Not only reaffirm it, but it allows us to even deepen it. Because so much of our cushion time, we can kind of, you know, have a quiet room, a quiet, undistracted place. We're out there in our rubs with other people. That shows us all those places of binding, those places of restriction. There's really, those are the gifts. Those guides from beyond, as Rudini said. So stepping outside of our opinionation, that sense of, okay, I'm right and you're wrong. Willingness to step outside of that and to deeply listen. It's renouncing, informed by the wisdom of non-self. Even stepping outside of our comfort zone. You know, what do we normally, you know, there's a certain narrow range that we usually operate in. You can see it in the class, like an evening like this. There's some people who are very comfortable speaking in front of a large group, and other people who aren't so comfortable. And so when people have the courage to step up and say something, they're loosening that, those deep belief in that sense of self. They're starting to soften around that. It's a practice of renouncing, renunciation. And so as our wisdom grows, as it deepens, we start to renounce more and more deeply. And more subtle aspects of dukkha are shown as an opportunity to release. Our subtle ways we don't align with anicca, with impermanence, subtle ways of a sense of self is believed in and reinforced. And so as a practice naturally unfolds, there you are. There's a point where we realize that we can't renounce the self, that the self can't renounce itself. It's like that artist who drew the two hands drawing each other. It's like you can't keep drawing to the point where it stops being there. And at that point, we shift to a much deeper renunciation, this full surrender, this full release, that we release the position of self itself. Then life becomes this constant process of change, of flux, of flow, and we no longer grasp, because it makes no longer any sense. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as we sit, what is wisdom? How does wisdom inform renouncing in this very moment? In this very moment. And seeing if this quality of renouncing leads to freedom. Leads to the heart inviting, opening. So thank you. So I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. And so I'm offering to hold this simple question. Does this lead to suffering or to freedom? Right? So you can just hold that question and whatever arises in your experience, and there's this choice of how am I going to relate to this? How am I going to connect with this? Am I going to act from it, not to act from it? Holding that question, does this lead to freedom or to more suffering? So if something leads to suffering, see if there's a natural arising of renouncing. Is there a sense of naturally wanting to renounce, intention of renunciation arises? And also notice carefully, and this is reinforcing this point, that renunciation is not about what arises in our minds. It's about our relationship to it. If we focus on what arises, it's very easy, very seductive, to go fall into self-judgment, self-criticism, preferencing. You know, this is good, this is not good. So it's not about what arises, it's how do we relate to what's arising. In that relationship, that's where the renouncing can happen. So you start to become more and more just allowing, okay, this mind state arises, this sense of anger, the sense of grief, a sense of fear, of lust, whatever it might be, it becomes able to be fully welcome, just like that Rumi picture poem, opening your doors and let everyone in, and allowing it to sweep your house. So play with that, see how that sits with you, and then we can next week explore that more. So we have some chance for any comments or questions or sharing that we can explore the last bit of time. Yes.
Sometimes if you're in the group, if I'm in the grip of a really strong emotion, mm-hmm. this feels a little dry. I suppose you're afraid.
Yeah.
How do you relate that to this? I'm just trying to have a picture of myself asking myself in the moment of being afraid, is this going to be
Yeah, so it's a good question. So question was about this approach of wisdom with renunciation feels a little dry and maybe not quite so applicable when there's a very strong emotion like fear. Like you're trying to, how do I actually do that in the midst of fear? And there's a reason I started with the compassion aspect of it, because that's almost the kind of the prefacing. So when there's something that's very, very, gripping, very painful, very, you know, very meaningful for you. There's a lot of real personal fear that's happening. That's when the compassion comes in. Okay, the sense of, okay, I'm going to really connect with the fact that this I'm suffering right here. Right. So from that point of compassion, that starts to allow wisdom to come in afterwards. I think that's, for most people, that's probably a good safeguard just because of our tendencies to get contract, to become so judgmental. It's to first connect with the fact that this is a difficult experience. You know, that in itself, just to highlight, connecting with it as a difficult experience, you're seeing it. You're turning a quality of heart to it that cares that you're suffering versus going into more contraction, more thinking about it, more fear about it, more anxiety. So what you're renouncing in that moment through compassion is all the anxiety and worry. You're instead touching it with your heart. Okay? So there's like that quality of compassion. And then there's a, you know, once that feels like that's softened and that seems malleable, feels like it's you can really work with it, then there's the wisdom that comes in also. Not to say wisdom is better than compassion. They are really one and the same. They're really different aspects of the same thing. It can be helpful to kind of tease them apart, highlight the one aspect of the kind, caring heart, especially with painful things. And then as wisdom comes in. And again, the homework was talking about to see if the intention of renunciation arises. So fear comes up, and there's like, I'm not going to renounce this. This is, I got to do something about this. It's, you know, it's not arising. It's not like make it arise. You know, it's just, okay, if it arises, that's great. If it not, then come back to that compassion. Thank you. Yes.
Where there's a lot of avoidance that comes up, and I really work on metta to try to release it. But then I want to be compassionate when really the underlying feeling is hate.
And then I am also, after tonight, really thinking about what's my own stuck identity in sort of perpetuating this story of this difficulty, and how, what am I really gaining, you know, from that perpetuation? So sort of how do I have compassion for the avoidance and the difficulty that arises, but also like try to work on sensations that are less harmful, and so renunciate that difficulty and have compassion for it at the same time, and then try to release my identity around it. That's, I think, really what's perpetuating the whole thing in the first place.
Yeah, so that's a nice question. Just to try to summarize it, that there's kind of a jumble of conflicting qualities, you know, around a particular issue, that there's, you know, wanting to have metta toward it, to have compassion for it, but underneath there's really this anger toward it. There's a sense that, you know, my identity is really a, kind of one of the linchpins around that. And, you know, how do you work with this? Is that... And first, I'd just like to say that those times are actually a very nice gift. Some of the times that we felt so locked, this is so confusing, I don't know which way I should go, those are actually very important gifts. Because it's almost like there's a change of strategy that's happening. Kind of our normal way of relating to life is like it's not quite making sense. You know, and we want to try a different way. But we kind of have one foot in one way and one foot in the other way. So we're kind of in this big tangle. It's like Twister, you know, put your left hand on your right, you know. And so you're kind of still playing the game, but you also are realizing that there's another way. And so sticking with it, having that perseverance to stick with it, there's times that I've done that with those kind of really difficult tangles. There's often a very deep opening that comes around that. Very much because of what you said, with that deep sense of self and belief that's on the core of it. So part of it is to I don't know if this analogy will resonate at all, but like magicians, you know, do all this distraction, like, you know, look over here, and they're, you know, slipping this coin over here, and you get distracted. These kind of states have all these different misdirections, that we really get allured by the thoughts and the emotions and, you know, all that stuff. But underneath there's just this simple trick that's happening, right? And that's the sense of self, the sense of belief around it. So start to back yourself into that. First thing is to fully allow your whole experience. Any part of your experience which is, you kind of like, okay, I don't really like that anger part. You know, I'd much rather be the metta meditator than the angry, fuming meditator. You know, that's more, you know, aligned with my sense of how I want to be. Okay, so you try to renounce all that editing. Okay, you want to have an unedited, full take of how you are. Okay, so that's the first thing, is whenever there's a sense of kind of pushing that down, okay, that's actually what I need to turn toward. And really, let me fully invite that anger in, fully feel that rage, okay? And as you do that, paradoxically, you start to soften. Because a lot of the tension, a lot of the tie-in is kind of the energy that has to go in to try to say, okay, suppress this part versus this part. So first, there's going to be a little bit of an explosion. You know, it's like, oh, you know, but as you do that, then you start to say, okay, you come more into balance. And in that state, then you start to reorient to what's the belief, what's the worldview with here? You know, it's often a very, very simple, very personal, often a very, it doesn't make sense often from our normal way of thinking, but like, you know, maybe, you know, like the one I talked about, like not belonging or just not being loved. Okay, so, you know, as an adult woman, that's not, you know, it was really engendered as a young child. So that sense of, okay, connecting to that quality of not being loved, right? And feeling the pain of that, and that longing, and that trying to fulfill that. And then suddenly you reorient to all this display, reorients to this much deeper pain, and then coming back to that quality of compassion. And being with it as long as it needs to be. At some point, there'd be a sense of seeing even beyond that pain, and then the renouncing happens effortlessly. So an important thing is not to use renunciation as a force of will, of trying to shape yourself in a certain way or getting rid of stuff before then the heart naturally releases it. And it's a magical thing because you can, it just feels like there's no way to get around this. And by working with it in the way we just talked about, suddenly there's a shift and he's like, oh, I'm not no longer part of it, no longer, I'm outside of that system. I can see, and you know it because there's a deep compassion that arises for that pain. And there's also maybe a sense of humor that, oh, this is so funny that I was taking this so seriously when really it's just a thought. Yeah, so stick with it, you know, for months, you know, as long as it takes, for years. You know, that sense of urgency, that sense of really wanting to see this. Thank you for the question. Yeah, Ed.
So I appreciate your talk. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think inviting compassion to join in renunciation makes a lot of sense to me. As you're describing the wisdom part, my question is about how to invite more penetrating wisdom into the equation. So I've had experiences on retreat where the wisdom, it's not like thinking, it's direct knowledge, that kind of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and all the awakening factors are there, there's energy, there's
right,
clarity,
yeah.
it's not even close, it's sort of direct,
right.
No arguing, it's not, it's just what it is. But in normal life, wisdom has such a quality of thinking, at least it does with me, that it's more like debating, correct, not correct, just more thinking involved.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on inviting more of that direct wisdom to play a part.
Thank you. So the question is thoughts about inviting this more direct, penetrating wisdom, especially in a daily life. You know, in the conditions on retreat, it's often much more accessible. And I think just in retreats do create a certain conditions. I mean, we were practicing much of it is just the prolonged practice, the forms, the, you know, everything's oriented toward just seeing, right? So in daily life, what replaces that is curiosity, sincerity, and urgency. So there's a sutta where the Buddha talks about, you know, if your hair was on fire, how much, you know, debate would it take to take care of that problem? You know, it's just like you're just like there's no question that you need to be completely there. All right, so there kind of like some of the gateways for that, one is can be pain, you know, really seeing the pain. You know, so it's actually helpful the more painful it is. Sometimes it's not so painful, so it's kind of like we don't have enough motivation to really penetrate, to really connect. It's like, oh, you know, this is painful. This is just, you know, I'm just kind of curious about it. But when it's like so painful, it's like going to your core and there's no way to get out of it, you know, then that urgency comes up. So that's one side. Another side is a sense of deep curiosity, a sense of really, okay, I'm really curious about this. And that takes a little bit more energy to sustain. You have to keep putting coal on the fire, okay, you know, calling yourself back from all the distractions of life. that quality of curiosity and sincerity, there's a kind of a very brutally honest quality that's needed too. You know, because we are so good at hiding parts of ourselves. Of there's such a momentum of unconsciousness, so much delusion. That's really and especially things which have that grip to us has like a whole layer of extra unconsciousness around it. So there's this willingness to keep coming back to that, to keep really looking at that. And any time, what I would suggest is noticing any time there's a quality of friction, have a sense of not really wanting to look at that, a sense of pushing that away or preferencing toward this. Like, oh, I really like this state, this kind of, I feel good thinking about this, right? And by doing that, you also, if you really are honest, you notice there's a opposite direction. Right? And so sometimes playing with opposites, like let's say, is there an example of an area that you're trying to, I'll put you on the spot for a second. Well, so I'll give you one. I won't give you one, but I'll just give an example of one that, let's say I want to really understand the momentum, the urge to keep creating a sense of self, to keep reforming. So there, on one hand, I'm really looking at, okay, all the different qualities of how that, that movement toward contraction, really understanding all the way it manifests. But I also need to look at the payoff. It feels good to kind of be a miserable self versus, be a no self. It's like there's that, that preferencing, wanting to be pitiful feels kind of, I know who I am if I'm pitiful. So that deep honesty is important, because then you start to, that starts to loosen things up. So I hope that helps. May you have lots of pain. Yes. So what did I say? Which ones? Curiosity. Urgency, sincerity, and curiosity. Yes. Yeah, that's a nice question. So as she becomes more uncomfortable with the process of change within herself, she finds people around her try to put her back in that old way of being. And it's like the sense of fighting with it, or how do you navigate that? One thing I would encourage you to do is notice how you do that to other people. So you start to really understand that way we project on other people, how, my parents are always going to be that way, or my friends are always going to be that way. And, not with a quality of judgment or a sense of trying to do anything with it, but just to notice that there's this way the mind kind of leans into, it wants to reassure itself. It knows that the future will be like the past, or the present will be like the past. And just notice that quality. And really, when I say notice, it's like you're not only identifying and seeing when it's arising, but really feel how that is in the body. And doing so, you start to have a deeper understanding of that and how it is, it's a, there's like fear with that, there's a quality of wanting to control, there's the sense of, if I really relax that, then I lose control. But the other side, when I do relax it, then you also notice when you don't do that, when you allow yourself to be very fresh with things, then there's a sense of freedom, a sense of really dancing with life, that sense of spontaneous matching what's arising. And when you start to get a sense of that, when someone, you know, tries to put you back in how you were, you know, last year or 10 years ago, whatever it might be, then there's this, you have much more of a freedom around it. It's like, okay, they want me to go this way. And sometimes they say, I'll step right into that. And I'll act from that a little bit, but then shift it. Or sometimes I'll say, well, that's not me anymore. You know, and so you, it's like there's a way of, it's often a fragile, there's a fragility to it as we start to open beyond our normal confines. And that fragility is what makes it feel like something you have to defend and have to kind of push against. Once you start to become more, it starts to really seep into you, then it's like people can say things it's like the wind blowing a certain way. I remember back to my preschool, I don't remember back to my preschool, but I remember my daughter's preschool. This one point, this boy was just really enraged at me. I have no idea what I did, but he was just sitting there yelling at me. I was like, you know, I got down to his level and just listened, because it had no personal hook to me, and I was able to fully meet him. Okay, and so right now, what's happening is there's a personal hook that's happening. That sense of gripping that, you know, can't you see that I'm a different person? All right, so you treat that as a quality of pain, of compassion. I think at some point you'll find that you're just naturally embody those changes much more. And people say, oh, you know, they start to go that way, and they realize, well, that doesn't fit. They'll see that for themselves. And you won't have to say anything. You just, your life will be a statement of that. All right, so thank you for those sincere questions and your kind attention.